Today's special guest, Bob Hoy of Institutional Advisors. Well, my featured guest today has advised institutional clients for over three decades. Bob Hoy is Editor-in-Chief Investment Strategist of InstitutionalAdvisors.com. And Bob, I understand it's just lovely today in Vancouver.
Yeah, we've got 40 degrees and sunshine. And you've got to understand that this part of Canada is, we call it the banana belt. It's because it's always milder. And it's a very easy climate to live in.
After the most mild winter that I can recall in decades, roads are shut down. At least 6 inches of solid accumulation on the roads, I'd say, are close to it.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at the eastern side of the, you know, west, east of the Rockies, and the temperatures are, you know, you get that 14-day forecast, and they put in the bands, typical high and the typical low. In some places, like even down to St. Louis, Missouri, the high is below the typical low band, and there's another, it's essentially 2 weeks of it yet to come. And I just out of curiosity, I checked them for Duluth and Detroit, and then right up into Canada, Toronto, places like that, and it is unusually cold.
Yep, well, so much for global warming, I guess.
We can talk about that one on another edition.
Yeah, let's do that. We have in the past and bored people's socks off, so we won't force them to endure that episode again. But start today, Bob, with the latest Fed meeting. You know, we heard from the Fed minutes last week. You could tell the governors are in no hurry to increase the benchmark lending rate. Clearly, some of the policymakers are inclined to hold rates steady, those unsettling conditions in the Eurozone. You know, we see, of course, Greece trying to determine whether or not they will remain a viable component in the Euro region. And I think there's also some concern on the economic numbers. You know, although things were robust for a couple of months, they tend to be around the holidays. And of course, with the cold weather, we're seeing some declining economic numbers here domestically. We also saw housing starts drop off. Factory production was lackluster. Economic output maybe not quite as robust as people thought. Tell us what you think about the Fed meeting minutes and what it might mean for the markets, please.
Well, I think a month or so ago, Janet Yellen said something that they would leave perhaps the administered rate to follow what market rates of short rates do. I thought that was an interesting revelation. I don't know how widely it was broadcast, but essentially the Federal Reserve had been running a scam now for 100 years, and they are just winging it. They, on one side, they want to look like they're in control, but when interest rates are going up for market forces, they then try and do something else. So, but let's just take a look at, if you read the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, the writer reviews the intention of forming the Federal Reserve back in the early days. And they had observed that if you have a financial pressures mounting, the discovery of bad lending, which you often get on a boom, they theorized that if the Federal Reserve was there to provide liquidity, like the lender of last resort thing, that then there wouldn't be financial setbacks and then there wouldn't be recessions. That was the theory. So then you look back and using the NBER determination of business cycle, there's been 19 recessions since. There's been two financial manias, 1929 and 2007, and two drastic financial collapses. And so here, and then even on the drastic financial collapses, rather than just ordinary ones, in the 1970s, the then young and much admired liberal economist, Lester Thurow, he said, well, of course, policymaking's working. It's prevented the last six recessions from turning into a depression. If you follow the business cycle to the peak in 1929 from the depression bottom in 1895, there were 10 booms and busts, recessions and contractions and expansions. And then, of course, up to 2007, that was number 10. So you don't start worrying about a potential depression at the sixth recession. So the problem with the dominant economic theory, which is to intervene for any reason, is that these guys have theories that are based not upon history or empirical evidence, but just upon notions. And that notion is very old. The first guy to come up with the idea that you could show credit at a credit contraction and it would go away occurred a long time ago. There was a credit boom in England and that blew out in 1618, repeat 1618, crashed down to 1623, lots of hardship, unemployment, a whole nasty mess. And then a guy by the name of Edward Misselden, in an otherwise relatively sane paper, pamphlet, did include the idea that you could create money from somewhere and get it into the credit markets and all would be well. And then, of course, you then move forward to 1873 when, in still very admired guy, Bagehot, he headed up the Economist magazine. And in 1873, he published a book called The Lombards, which was the financial center. And in that book, he theorized that with a financial setback, the senior central bank could provide enough funds to prevent a serious contraction. 1873 was the top of a bubble, and the depression lasted to 1895. So then he came along, and then in 1930, well, prior to 1929, Keynes was relatively lucid, and then he he'd made money for his college at Twitter, Cambridge, whatever it was for, maybe on inside information, I don't know, but he took a tremendous hit in the 1929 crash, and then looked around and invented this concept called the liquidity preference. And theorized that if an agency provided lots of credit, the credit contraction would go away. So the amazing thing is that Friedrich Hayek, in the 1940s and later, said that at the time that Keynes put together his theory published in 1936, he was completely ignorant of financial or economic history. So all of this is intuitive. And just to wrap this one up, Chris, the reason why something as absurd as Keynesian economics and intervention came to the forefront and has been dominant is that it provides huge funds and power to the state. If it didn't do that, it wouldn't be around. So now, of course, it's become absolutely dominant, whereby half the world is hanging on the conjectural statements by the current head of the Federal Reserve. And it can move markets, but at some point, historians will look backwards on this thing and say it was absolutely absurd. The audacity of these people who think that they have the skills to manage an economy.
A contemporary of John Maynard Keynes, Frank Knight, an American economist from the Middle West, who eventually found his way to the University of Chicago and helped craft the Chicago School of Economics as we know it today. In fact, he undoubtedly would have received a Nobel Prize in economics if one had existed at the time. And several of his well-known students subsequently did earn said prize, including Milton Friedman, Friedman. But Frank Knight had a very witty, down-to-earth manner, and he echoed your sentiments that economics is a profoundly simple subject. The current neo-Keynesian methodology and ideologies are so foreign from what I think Dr. Keynes would have recognized at his time, nearly 100 years ago.
Well, Keynes did have the notion that a government could operate counter to whatever was going, both fiscally and financially. So he had the idea that it was not a one-way street of accommodating everything in sight. So, but you had another American economist. He worked at Chase Bank, Benjamin Anderson. Okay. He was the economist at Chase, wrote his monthly piece through the 1920s, and he had a handle on financial asset inflation and also wrote the best account afterwards. But the interesting thing is that the head of that bank then was a guy by the name of Wiggin. And in 1929, at the top of the market, he shorted it, not only sold his own stock, but he shorted Chase Manhattan stock at the top of the market. Then it crashed. He made money. Of course, the establishment got upset. So then there was a little bill or an act or something put in afterwards that then bank directors couldn't short their own stocks.
The one who really made the fortune during the 29 crash was Livermore. The rumors, I think, far outweigh the truth here. I mean, according to the legend, I mean, he was so heavily short that he made close to $200 million, which at that time would be several billion dollars.
I've read some good sources on Livermore and on a day-to-day basis, and he played the short side of the market all the way down, you know, shorting, covering, all the way down. And he made about $25 million by the time he got to the bottom. And then personally something went wrong with him so that by about 1940, he couldn't play the long side, whereas hitherto he could.
Jim Sinclair, his father, actually worked with Jesse Livermore on a daily, you know, a regular basis. And I've gotten the inside scoop on the air and off the air over the years, information that you will not find in any of the interesting books that we've all read on Jesse Livermore. And really none of the things that have been written about the near the end of his life are true, that he actually wasn't broke. He got a couple bad apples working for him in that office.
Well, I know he, and on the boom, he had something like 15 guys working with him, mainly, you know, getting information. His office had about 15 people in it just to, you know, keep track of things. But anyways, it's always interesting to talk history. And the question was, what about the central bank utterances? I think that deep inside each one of them, they know that they're in a very, very bad place. They've got a tiger by the tail, and the moment they quit pushing credit out, and who knows, the Fed said that it stopped the buying of bonds, but there's other manipulations that they can do, and of course they passed the baton over to the European Central Bank, and it's supposedly buying bonds, but I read one here this morning where the institutions there are not selling bonds because they would have to pay huge capital gains. And if you're a life company or casualty insurance, you've got certain actuarial things to meet. So, and their demands are sort of like 3 to 3.5% annually. And so they sell what they got, pay a huge capital gain, and then reinvest at 0.5%. So they're just not doing it. So it's going to be interesting how successful the European community is at inflating credit. My view is to watch commodities, and if they continue to be dull and disappointing, it's an indication that the only hookup that the central bankers have is with their easing, is with financial assets. And you got to go back to the 70s. Well, actually, you know, when you think about it, Chris, the gold bug story has been around since the mid-1960s, Jim Dines and others. But at that time, when I was working with a high-end investment dealer, this was sort of looked at scornfully. But it's worked out. But the story essentially was is that the Fed is depreciating currency. And if you were a gold bug, then gold would outperform everything else. But if you're a hard asset guy, commodities, then they would outperform everything else. And what you did have was a tremendous inflation in commodities, producer prices, and wages. And that peaked in 1980 at a huge speculative blow-off in commodities. And then, much like 1920, in which case there was then a crash in commodities. And the interesting thing is that since then, because Volcker was head of the Fed then, he's given credit for ending inflation. If you take a look at the annual money supply numbers, there was no break. They kept inflating credit, but the public shifted over from speculating in commodities, and by the bear market bottom in 82 and the turn to the bull market, then they began in speculating in financial assets. Now, I was providing institutional services then, and was really just starting to market it, because prior to that I'd been retained by a couple of the big mining companies for research on metals. But going to the institutions then in 1981, my pitch was that no matter how much the Fed prints, financial assets will outperform commodities. Now, at that stage of history, major institutions in North America had finally figured out that inflation wasn't due to prices going up. It was due to the Fed depreciating. So they had just discovered the cause of inflation, and they couldn't accept a story that that type of inflation was over and you'd have a new kind. And even to this day, your typical central banker hasn't got a clue about financial asset inflation. And indeed, whenever they mention inflation, it only means CPI inflation. So they're in a hellhole, really. Maybe some realize it, but you've got this condition whereby interventionists have not just been in the credit market, but there's so many rules and regulations in Western economies now, just unbelievable, that is throttling business inclinations and abilities. So it's just got a chokehold on it. And then they arbitrarily decide that GDP should be higher or employment should be better. And what did they resort to? Credit inflation. And it's been going into financial assets. You've got, in Europe, you've got the 10-year German note bid down to 0.35%. I mean, it's totally absurd. Interest rates have never been this low, but the really curious thing is that the guys at the central banks don't understand it. They think, oh, they want to get inflation up to 2%, which is state theft, of course. And so when I get asked about Fed policy, the usual is that they don't know what they're doing. And at some point, as in 1980, where the public had speculated enough in hard assets, got burned out, and then a couple of years later started to play in financial assets. So now, this is why I said, you know, you've been in a bear market for commodities and base metals and for precious metals since 2011. And at the same time, central bankers in the West see with easing credit. So here's where the really tricky part comes in, Chris, is that without a bid in the financial markets, would the central bankers have been as successful in getting credit out? Because I think that they need speculators in something in order to expand their portion of the credit expansion. When is the speculation in long treasuries? Well, that peaked five or six weeks ago, and we did our usual technical analysis on it, and we had upside exhaustions and all kinds of things on it, and wrote that this was probably the opposite to the bond market in 1981, when you had U.S. long treasury trading at 15%. You got under 2%. So this will tell the tale, Chris. If a bear market for the long bond develops, then they're pushing on a rope. Low-grade junk corporate bonds in the U.S., a speculative high last June. And then they've had a huge setback to the middle of December, had a rebound where they're now overbought and can head south. So what I think is going to happen here is that the credit markets have become extremely speculative. The Treasury bond has become as speculative. Stock market has been in highly speculative conditions, showing sentiment and momentum numbers seen only at previous cyclical highs. So it's all there. Party time. And if I were a fund manager, I don't know what I'd do, because by now I think the average fund manager has figured out that what's keeping the stock market up is the aggressive action by central bankers, and also their very speculative utterances where, you know, it's. I think at some point here they're going to have in the mornings, the Federal Reserve say that it's going to be easing, and then in the afternoons in Europe, the central bank in Europe is going to have to say they're easing, because this is what is driving the market. I looked at a study here the other day of from, I think, the 60s, and they took the Standard & Poor's Monthly, and they ran it, you know, as it is, not adjusted by anything, and then they adjusted it for, and they took the, each year they took out the 25 big updates out of it, where you had they had it at $1,000 in, say, 1965. It got up to $5,000 in 2000, back down, and then now it's sort of like $3,900. So if you take out the 25 best days of a year, there's not been a huge amount of growth in the stock market since 2000. So then I'm going to get in touch with the guys who did the study. Then what they should do is put in how many of those big days in the stock market were due to a Fed announcement. Curious, isn't it? It's interesting. So, yeah, so it's become actually a highly promotional world on the central banking side. Their theories that they can run, manage an economy have always been highly speculative, and now they're adding that to, with day-to-day market operations that are speculative as well. And then you've got the fund managers who should not be speculative, but they have become speculative. So it's fascinating, because Keynesian economist, lefty guy, I don't remember his name, Professor Tobin, in the 80s said that a bubble is a speculation upon what other speculators are doing in their speculations, something like that. I haven't got it word perfect. So we are in a fantastic bubble, and the old notion of Keynes for that the central bank should sort of lean into the wind a little isn't happening.
I mean, what's happened is when you open up Pandora's box, as Keynes proposed and many others, on paper, it's a fantastic equation. The problem is, in practice, by around the year 2000, we had, of course, as you know, lost our fail-safes that we'd picked up during the 1930s as a result of maybe the most notable speculative bubble that we had had in many generations. We had those fail-safes. We kept the investment banking side away from the day-to-day mom-and-pop banking, and that kept the speculation, at least on a big scale, out of the markets. But what happens when you remove those fail-safes, and then it still isn't enough to save the system? The Fed has to come in with the working group of markets, so they keep pouring money into the money center banks. Those banks then dole out the funds to the major corporations. The corporations certainly don't do anything with it except buy back their own treasury stock.
They're borrowing money to buy their stock. Talking to an accountant in New Jersey the other day, and he says some of his big account guys, they've been in business long enough to run a pretty tight ship, and they found that so they laid on a whole lot of debt, and they didn't earn any more money, but the stock went up. here's the point where we're talking about central banks. And I made this note just yesterday, so it's fresh out. This is by Dr. Pippa Malmgren, and she's a former member of the U.S. President's Working Group on Financial Markets, i.e., that was the plunge protection team. So now she's coming out and saying that there is no price discovery anymore by the market. Governments impose prices on the market. And this is where you have such loftiness in the stock market. But my contention is that they cannot run it forever. Also, that there's no way that these guys are going to get religion and suddenly say, hey, what we've been doing is wrong, and stop doing it. So then Mother Nature and Mr. Market, Mr. Margin, are going to do it to them. And so then you want to see where the hottest action has been. And to 2011, it was base metals and precious metals. 2008 was the huge blow-off in crude oil. And then the failure since last June in crude oil is a very important step. And all of the easing in the world isn't going to hold crude oil from... Sure, it's going to... We ran it, as you recall, that once you get a bear market going in crude, that it can last, the severe part can last 6 or 7 months. Now, that counted out to January. So in January, we noted this, and we'd been talking about the count to January, and when it was down at 43 or whatever it was kind of oversold. But here's the other part of historical research, is that once the, say, let's call it the initial low was in, that you don't get a V-bottom and you go right back on up. You can take months to set a bottom with churning back and forth. So this is where I think the wild action in crude since January has been, that there's a lot of bulls out there thinking a V-bottom, and then there's Mother Nature thinking otherwise. So, and on, I forget which one it was, but the shortest bottom in a time in establishing a bottom after a crude crash was 2 months. So, I think there's no need to run into crude. And, of course, it's having a dampening effect on the commodities that have been coming down since 2011. I think the commodity side will tell the tale. Then on the other side, you go back to 2006, which was the peak in the housing mania with subprime mortgages and the government urging people, all people should own houses whether they could afford it or not, and the whole thing was rigged. So then you got the equivalent now going on in car sales. People are taking 7-8 year loans on car sales. And there's a whole sub-industry set up bundling up car loans and turning them into A-rated mortgage bonds. So it's the same thing, only in something as perishable as a car rather than a house. And they're even doing used cars on this. So at any rate, here's a place to watch would be car sales. You can't say it's insanity or madness on the part of the policymakers, because underneath it all, they are rational people. But what you can say is fanaticism, and they're in too deep to quit. And as the very vivid imagery of holding a tiger by the tail very much illustrates what's going on, you can't let go. We're watching any price series that has been a blow-off condition to reverse. The latest one, of course, is the Treasury market, and the stock market staying in there. And if you look at the broader market, the U.S. NYSE composite, the symbol's NYA, it's sort of working on a big rounded top. And then we're just doing a chart now on the global equity market, not including U.S., And it's in a similar pattern seen in 2007, also seen in 2000. So we have those two recent examples to guide us in the stock market. And I don't think, now here we're going to finish up with gold. The latest rally was very nice. My colleague Ross Clark is the technician in our team, and he was calling for a correction down to 1,200 to 1,225. So we're there, but we're not yet calling for a rally in gold's dollar price. And then this also is worth pointing out that the when you're positioning gold, you're essentially, you could say the old idea you can own 5 or 10% of your assets in gold, put it in the safety deposit box. That's sound. But if you're positioning gold to make a capital gains out of it, that's not going to work. What you're doing is essentially trading in foreign exchange markets. So whether it's somebody in the U.S. positioning against U.S. dollars or Canada with Canadian or European, that is a speculation in foreign exchange. What we prefer to do is work with investors and on sound principles of investing and look at the gold mining industry. And it rests upon the profitability of gold mining. How much are they getting for the bullion and how much of their costs are? Now, here's the irony, is that when you're in a business boom, usually the cost of everything goes up relative to the price of gold. And gold miners don't do so well. But when you're in a deflationary contraction, typically the price of most everything falls relative to gold. So the way we keep track of this is with the gold divided by our own commodities index. And it set what we took to be a cyclical low in June last year. And it's recovered a huge amount. But because you got so much excitement in junk bonds, but certainly in treasuries and then in the stock markets, there's no time for the gold. So the gold's real price is on a cyclical bull market and will more than likely continue. The gold stocks came down to a very nasty low in around Christmas time. Now, our November special study on gold pointed all this out and said that what we needed for the position in gold shares would be, first of all, to have gold stocks outperforming the bullion price. That has been happening. The other one would be silver beginning to outperform gold, and that's been bottoming and basing as well. So the idea was to accumulate gold stocks on weaker markets, but we're not fully invested yet because this bottom here can be a long process. We know that the juniors are, but it's kind of improving a little.
You know, we are seeing improvement in the XAU, HUI. It's slow but steady, backing and filling. The one caveat that I think is keeping a lot of technicians up at night, consolidation at the same level now for almost a year, maybe going on a year and a half. That's an ominous sign from a long, long-term basis. It implies a strong potential for a capitulation moment, which might be what's necessary, I think, to shake the weak hand, the folks that were late to the bull market, out of this market. I certainly hope I'm wrong.
We agree that the gold's dollar price is precarious, but I'll take you one step further on our historical work, and that is in the post-bubble environment, the senior currency, which is still the U.S., becomes chronically strong or firm relative to most commodities, and relative to most commodities for most of the time, which has been happening. And so how do we then balance our different views whereby we're looking for a constantly firmer U.S. dollar and we're bullish on the gold industry? So you have to take out the dollar price of gold and look at the real price. And if the real price is going up, the profitability will eventually start, operating profitability will eventually come in because you're dealing with a bear market in the gold sector. you saw the end of a 10-year bull market in 2011 where the seniors like Barrick Gold were doing uncertain geology in uncertain political regimes and then getting into copper and stuff like that. So all of those bad mistakes have yet to be washed out, but we'll just stay with our point of view that investors will be looking to the earning side of gold shares. And they will also understand that on the next recession, that the real price of gold will continue to go up and profitability will continue to improve for the industry. And then I'll just throw in that in all of the five previous post-bubble contractions, gold mining became the premier industry. Now, there could be some new industries or new concepts, new technical stuff, and create a bubble, or not a bubble, but a good returns from that particular stock. But the one thing that you can analyze is that in a post-bubble contraction, eventually the gold sector becomes the premier and the most reliable money earner. And this is... we're getting close to starting that, Chris, so you can mark us down as very bullish on the long term, very careful on the entry.
As I'm sure you remember last week, the Swedish central bank has dropped rates into negative territory. There's capital controls in all over Scandinavia, including Denmark. We're seeing the ECB now has one of its lending rates in negative territory. And as we learned from, you know, Barsky and Summers, when you have negative real rates, that is a perfect world for gold. And it certainly would support your thesis that maybe we see a stealth rally in the precious metals on a forward basis. Bob Hoy, could you please tell our listeners today more about the interesting services you provide and how they can sign up for them?
We do research on a weekly basis, covers interest rates, credit spreads, yield curve, commodities, and we do some unique research on the precious metals sector. We send the same product to institutions, to high net worth people and individuals, and you can find us at institutionaladvisors.com. Or an easier way is just to Google my name, B-O-B-H-O-Y-E, Bob Hoy, and that gets you into our service. And we welcome new subscribers, and we put you on the system for 5 or 6 weeks. If you like it, you stay on and pay a fee, and if you don't, that's fine too. So easy to get in touch with.
Excellent. Well, Bob Hoy, we appreciate your thoughts, and we'll look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com Radio.
Very good, Chris. Look forward to talking to you.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.